analogy that I found really helpful in trying to emphasize both the trustworthiness of science, but also the provisionality of science, is to say science is on a journey. It's traveling. It hasn't yet arrived at definitive answers. It hasn't yet reached its goal. And every now and then it may take wrong turnings. By that, I do not mean being misled. I mean rather the evidence being open to multiple interpretations and sometimes too much emphasis being placed on one option rather than the other. But the whole point here is that you cannot freeze this journey and say, that's the way things really are. The issue is to appreciate that this is where we are at this moment in time. We believe these are trustworthy, but we also know that it's very possible that what we believe now will be shown to be either incomplete or perhaps even wrong in 40 or 100 years' time. Hi, I'm Alistair McGrath, and I'm the Andreas Idris Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford University.
Welcome to Language of God. I'm your host, Jim Stump. Today, we're bringing you a conversation with one of the iconic voices in the science and faith dialogue. Alistair McGrath was an atheist when he started studying physics as a young man, but by the time he finished at university, he was convinced that Christianity could bring together his scientific passions with many of the questions that lay outside the realms of science. Since that time, he's built up some serious credentials, including doctoral degrees in both science and theology, and he's been teaching, preaching, and writing on the subject for over 30 years. To say he's a prolific author is a bit of an understatement. His author page on Amazon runs on to 7 pages. The conversation in today's episode was one we had with Alistair back in January of 2020, and in it he hints that he'll be done writing books. We talked to him again on the podcast in the fall of 2020 about a couple of his other books. Well, it's been over 3 years since that original conversation, and according to his Amazon page, it doesn't seem like his writing is completely stopped yet. But he has retired from his position as the Andreas Idris Professor of Science and Religion at Oxford, a position which will be taken up this fall by Mark Harris. For this episode, I talked to Alistair about two of his books, A Theory of Everything That Matters and Narrative Apologetics. The first is a book about Einstein. Einstein's nearly universally known for his theory of relativity, which opened an entire new world to scientists. But Einstein also spent a lot of time thinking about questions that couldn't be answered by science. And compared to the scientific superstars of today, Einstein's thinking about religion was sophisticated and complex. We ask McGrath about those beliefs and what we Christians might learn from them today. In the second book, Narrative Apologetics, McGrath lays out a case for Christianity that is not as much about giving arguments as it is about telling stories. We're pleased to have him tell some of his own story here. Let's get to the conversation. We like to start these conversations by having our guests look back a little bit at their early life, perhaps, and tell us about some of the experiences that might have been formative for their interest in science. Do you have any of these, Alistair, that you'd share?
Well, I think my interest in science really began when I was about 6 or 7 years old, when a great uncle who was the head of pathology at one of Belfast's hospitals gave me an old brass microscope. And I began to look at pond water. I began to see all these complex life forms. And, you know, I thought, these are really interesting. I want to know more about this. And then went on, built myself a little telescope, began to look at the night sky. And I thought, you know, science, this is really good. This is about opening up a new world. It's so exciting. And that kind of vision of the excitement of engaging nature, it still is with me to this very day.
And you went on to study science then more formally?
I went on to Oxford University, where I did my first degree in chemistry, and I specialized there in quantum theory, which is really interesting. But then for my doctorate, I switched into the biological sciences, and so I worked with George Rader here at Oxford on complex biological systems and got my DPhil in molecular biophysics.
And what about your faith story? I know that you went through an atheist phase during university years. Where did that come from? What was the faith environment of your youth like growing up?
Well, I grew up in Northern Ireland, which is a very religiously polarised society. And back in the 1960s, I think it was very easy for me to draw the conclusion that religion was a source of conflict. It was also, of course, in conflict with science, which I felt was very, very worrying. And so I felt that to be a scientist was really intrinsically and necessarily also to be an atheist. And so when I arrived at Oxford, I was pretty much a committed atheist. But I think I began to realise when I arrived at Oxford that things just weren't that simple, and began to review and rethink things, and eventually began to feel that Christianity gave me this wonderful big picture of reality, which allowed me to welcome and indeed rejoice in science, while at the same time being aware of its limits. It said some very important things, which I welcome, but there were more things that needed to be said that lay beyond the scope of science.
Was that a gradual process, or were there any stark movements in that, in your coming to accept Christianity?
I think there were points of crystallization where suddenly I saw something that I hadn't seen before. And I remember one of these in particular when I was talking to Charles Coulson, who was then Oxford professor of theoretical chemistry. And he was explaining how he held his faith and his science together. And it was like someone turning a light on. I suddenly saw this works. I could make this work for me. And there are other moments as well. But I think that was a very important pivotal moment where I suddenly had this intellectual or imaginative framework were given to me and saw it worked and saw I could make it my own.
So after your work in science at the university, you then went on to do more formal work in theology too. Is that correct? What was that timeline like?
After I gained my doctorate in molecular biophysics, I began to study theology. In fact, I took a first degree in theology here at Oxford and then went on to do theological research, theological teaching. I think after about 20 years of studying theology, I felt I was in a position to begin to make connections between science and religion. So it took a long time, but it did mean that I had a very good familiarity of two fields, science and theology, and could actually begin to make the connections within integrity.
So you've combined these two interests then, science and theology, into a good long career now that spanned a couple of decades at least. Do you have any reflection on this academic discipline of science and religion over that time, perhaps how things have progressed, how maybe the focus has changed or topics have changed in the field and how things might have progressed?
To begin with, if I can put it like this, it was some very enthusiastic amateurs, you know, scientists who had an interest in religion or theologians who had a vague familiarity with science, in effect beginning to map out some possible areas of study. But what I've seen of late, I think, is an increased professionalization, a realization that you do need to master two fields if you're going to make them come together in a serious, informed dialogue. So there are lots of people now with two doctorates, both in science and theology, who are able to make these connections. Now, I think, and indeed I hope, this means that we now have a richer and deeper conversation.
Does it make sense to even ask if we are progressing at all? Is the field making progress in the kinds of questions that it's answering?
I think in the field of science and religion, it's difficult to talk about progress. I think that what we're seeing rather is a realization of the complexity of the issues. And I think one of the things I've noticed is that people are becoming much more aware of the provisionality of our responses, that we cannot give definitive answers in this field. But actually, the process of exploration itself is really helpful in that it begins to open up certain lines of inquiry to indicate certain lines of response, which may actually have long-term significance. So in that sense, there is progress. The conversation continues, even though it's a long way from coming to any determined goal.
So that's interesting. And outside of the academy, there's tremendous interest in science and religion, too, among lay people. And sometimes the lack of definitiveness, I think, can be frustrating for people who want to know answers. You're a Brit, but you know our American context pretty well, too. I wonder if you have any reflections on the differences you may encounter outside of the academy as you speak with people in churches and in other settings about science and religion, and maybe if there are differences between the two cultures that you notice.
I notice a number of things which I think are well worth reflecting on. One of them is this, that a lot of people are aversive to any kind of uncertainty. They want simple, straight answers. And of course, in both the fields of science and religion, and of course, at their interface, there's this real need to recognize the complexity of the questions. And very often we're giving tentative and slightly uncertain answers. And so some people really want simple answers. And for that reason, they will go to people who give them simple answers,
right,
even though those answers are sometimes extremely unreliable. So for me, there's a real need for people to recognize the complexity of these issues. Now, this, of course, is made worse by the different cultural climates in the United Kingdom and the United States. In the United Kingdom, I think we can live with this uncertainty. It's something we don't really worry about too much. But in a very polarized culture like the United States, you find people wanting to take sides in complex cultural debates. And very often that means being able to say with certainty, this is right and you guys are wrong. And of course, in this field, you can't say that. And therefore, if you want to say that, you're going way ahead of what the evidence allows. So I think there's a real need to, in effect, impress on people that we are, so to speak, really fumbling a little bit in the dark here. It's not always clear what the best way of understanding something is, or indeed how reliable the answers that we're giving actually are.
At BioLogos, as you know, we do our best to show in the primarily the American culture here that it's possible to take science seriously and the findings of Christian faith or the commitments of Christian faith seriously. One of the issues we constantly face, particularly as we're speaking to more conservative Christians, is that they see this tension between accepting what science has found, accepting the findings of science, versus realizing that science is fallible and sometimes makes mistakes. I wonder if you have any reflection on the best way to communicate the trustworthiness of scientific findings while at the same time admitting that it is a work in progress itself and subject to error.
The analogy that I found really helpful in trying to emphasize both the trustworthiness of science, but also the provisionality of science, is to say science is on a journey. It's traveling. It hasn't yet arrived at definitive answers. It hasn't yet reached its goal. And every now and then it may take wrong turnings. By that, I do not mean being misled. I mean rather the evidence being open to multiple interpretations and sometimes too much emphasis being placed on one option rather than the other. But the whole point here is that you cannot freeze this journey and say, that's the way things really are. The issue is to appreciate that this is where we are at this moment in time. We believe these are trustworthy, but we also know that it's very possible that what we believe now will be shown to be either incomplete or perhaps even wrong in 40 or 100 years' time. I mean, think, for example, about the massive changes in our thinking about the origins of the universe. 100 years ago, the scientific consensus was the universe has always been here. Now, the universe has a beginning. Science does change its mind, but that does not mean it's arbitrary or whimsical. It means it is driven by the evidence available, and that means you trust it, even though you also know it may change its mind because it changed its mind for good reasons.
Good, right. So we'd like to talk about a couple of your recent books. One of those is on Einstein. The other is called Narrative Apologetics. Let's start with Einstein. So we're recording this conversation almost exactly 100 years after Einstein's launch into the public eye. It was November of 1919 that newspapers in London and New York wrote headlines about the empirical confirmation of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Einstein very quickly became a celebrity, one of the greatest scientists who ever lived. But you say in the introduction to your book that his greatest achievement was arguably to become admired, even adored, by the wider public. What was it about this man that let him become a worldwide celebrity and led you to write a book about him?
I think one of the reasons why Einstein is so remarkable, and indeed why he stands out for so many people, it's not simply that remarkable hairstyle. It's this ability to bring things together, to make connections between things that other people thought were completely disconnected, and also to set out this big vision of reality. And that's certainly what we see in his general theory of relativity. So for Einstein, there was this bigger picture, and his role was to try and communicate this to a wider public. And for, I think, many people in that public, they find Einstein may be difficult to understand. hand, but at the same time, they had this sense he had seen something which nobody else had seen, and they were willing to listen to him and see if they could get their heads around what he had seen. In many ways, Einstein was almost like a scientific prophet or a cultural figure who was able to enrich people's understanding of the world in which they lived.
So you've called your book A Theory of Everything That Matters. I think often in scientific parlance, at least, a theory of everything is usually used more specifically about how science might be able to explain everything. But I think you mean it differently, right? In that Einstein himself recognized that there are limits on what science could ever explain.
Well, Einstein was very clear that the quest for a theory of everything was very important. And in fact, during the 1940s, he began to realize that he wasn't going to find this. But, and this is a really important point, Einstein felt that science was wonderful, but that it had its limits. And therefore, there was a need to find a broader vision, which included what science was able to tell us, as well as about deeper questions concerning values and the meaning of life. Hence the title of my book, A Theory of Everything, in brackets, That Matters, because Einstein was very clear that what really matters in life lies beyond science, and he saw his task as bringing together what science could disclose and what could be gathered from other sources, including ethics and religion.
So in A Theory of Everything, that seems to imply a coherent big picture of some sort that may lead us to think a kind of realism is true, according to which there's this objective world existing independently of us, right? Contrary to what some of the postmodern or constructionist views might claim. But these disciplines that Einstein's had such an important role in founding, quantum physics and relativity, do these seem to push against that kind of realism because it's so difficult for us to imagine as real how photons could go through two different slits at once, or how time can be different if you're traveling at different speeds? Is there any kind of tension there between the aspiration to have a theory of everything and these very difficult sciences that push us in the opposite direction?
I think Einstein was misunderstood by many people as being a relativist because of the use of this word relativity. And indeed, at one point, Einstein said, I wish I'd called it a theory of invariance, because then that misunderstanding would not have arisen. But Einstein's a realist. He's saying there is a universe beyond us which is open to our interpretation, but is not something that we create. But I think one of the points Einstein is very, very clear about is that there is a certain element of mystery to our universe. And that means that although we can represent this rationally, we cannot reduce it to purely rational concepts. And that means there will always be a tension between our natural ways of thinking and the way the universe actually is. So if you like, there is some mental discomfort caused by our engagement with the universe, not because realism has failed, but because our minds are simply unable to take in the universe in all its fullness. And for Einstein, we just had to learn to expand our own capacity to engage the world, to try and take this in, even though it was difficult to do.
So Einstein never identified as a Christian and even denied belief in a personal God. So there are some obvious differences we would have with him theologically. But you say that he has been, and I'm quoting, an important influence in helping me navigate my way towards what I consider a workable and meaningful account of how this strange universe works and what it and we might mean. Einstein opens the way to trying to develop a theory of everything that matters. How is this particularly for you as a Christian? How has Einstein helped?
I think there are many people who point in certain directions, who open up ways of thinking, who give me intellectual toolkits, and I use these in my own way, but I'm borrowing these. These people have helped me move on. And Einstein's one of these people. I'm not saying for one moment I agree with Einstein on everything. What I'm saying is he kind of gives me a vision for engaging this world. He opens up ways of thinking, and in many ways I'm traveling further down some roads than he does, but nevertheless he's opened them up for me. So what I'd want to say is that Einstein and indeed many other scientists are not delivering us complete answers, but they are beginning important conversations. They're giving us cues, they're giving us pointers, which can lead to us having this enriched vision of reality, which results from engaging with them, even if we end up going further than they do in our explorations.
Can you speak at all about what his religious beliefs may have been like?
Einstein's religious beliefs were rather eclectic and I think difficult to categorize, mainly because we have our own ideas for what religion ought to be, and it doesn't really map very well onto what Einstein meant by the term. Einstein didn't believe in a personal God and didn't really like the idea of any kind of religious ritual or anything like that. For him, religion was really about an appreciation of the complexity of this universe, its mystery, and above all, the fact that there is a mind behind the universe. Now, that's not any kind of orthodox religion, but you can see how you could build a navigable path from what Einstein is saying to, in effect, what, for example, Christianity or Orthodox Judaism are saying. In effect, Einstein is more to be valued for what he affirms than what he denies. He's a wonderful catalyst for these kind of conversations.
And then what about his understanding of the relationship to these extra-scientific beliefs or disciplines with regard to science? So sometimes he sounds like what we today might categorize as an independence theorist of trying to keep these separate, perhaps even close to Stephen Jay Gould and the non-overlapping magisteria. But is some of that just the fact that he was reacting to people who had the conflict model more in mind?
I think Einstein's view of science and religion is very much that of these are different and we've got to respect that difference. And in many ways, he compartmentalizes them. He doesn't really allow for much in the way of overlap or indeed all that much in the way of dialogue. So I would tend to place them on a map which sees science and religion as distinct entities. But in our minds, we can construct a relationship between them. And that's Einstein, and I'm very happy to accept that's what he says. In my case, though, I would want to say Einstein helps me to begin to create a constructive, enriching dialogue between science and religion, partly by identifying what they are, but also, and Einstein doesn't do this as well as I would like, beginning to enable a conversation that can lead to an enriched understanding of where these two things take us.
So one of the quotes of his that you note and that often gets used in these contexts is him saying, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." Can you unpack that a bit for us? What is he meaning and pointing toward in a statement like that?
Well, he's pointing out something I think very important. First of all, he's saying that actually the ultimate motivation for science is this religious sense of mystery and awe, this sense that there is something vast and wonderful to be discovered, and that animates, give impetus to, in other words, it stimulates the scientific enterprise. And the reference to being lame is simply saying you need a motivation to keep you going. And for the scientists, for Einstein at any rate, that motivation lay in what Einstein called religion, this sense of awe, mystery, wonder in the presence of this mind behind the universe. But Einstein was also clear that religion needed content, that actually it needed to be explored, opened up. It wasn't simply some amorphous mass of sentiment. It actually had certain cognitive beliefs. And that's why he's so clear that science, in effect, stops religion being blind. It, in effect, gives it something to get its mind around. And I think that's a very helpful way of thinking, even though personally I'd want to take it in a slightly different direction.
Is it worthwhile us speculating at all about conversations with Einstein now and perhaps what might open him up further to understanding a more personal God or the religious perspectives that we have? Are there any of these notions that he have that he just seems like he's on the brink of coming to accept some of the doctrines of Christianity even, or is this not worthwhile even speculating about?
It's always worthwhile speculating about these things, first of all, because it's interesting, but also it might end up opening up some interesting lines of discussion. Why did Einstein not believe in a personal God? He gives two reasons. Reason number one, because it's an anthropomorphism. We are constructing this mystery as if it was a human being. And secondly, because he in effect argues that if God is a person, then the laws of nature are not going to be respected. God will tinker with the structure of the universe. I think both of those can be successfully challenged. For example, talking about God as a person is actually really dealing with this idea of relationality. It's not so much anthropomorphism, it's finding an analogy that helps us to grasp the idea that God is not simply something we apprehend rationally, it's something that we can relate to at a much deeper level. And also, I mean, okay, so we don't want a God who messes around for laws of nature, but that in effect does not necessarily follow from the idea of God being personal. So my own view is that Einstein is very welcome to make these statements, and they're very interesting. But I think there's more that can be said. So that's a conversation I would love to have had with him sometime.
Hey, Language of God listeners. If you enjoyed the conversations you hear on the podcast, we just wanted to let you know about our animated video series called Insights. These short videos tell stories and explore many of the questions at the heart of the faith and science conversation. They're short, beautifully animated, and easily shareable. You can find them at biologos.org/insights or on the Biologos YouTube channel. All right, back to the show.
Well, we're getting into the territory of your second book here that we wanted to chat about a little bit, called Narrative Apologetics. Let's start with the noun apologetics, which sounds to many people like you're apologizing for your faith, but that's not what you mean here, right?
Right. Apologetics sounds awfully like saying sorry for things. And of course, we need to be clear that apologetics may indeed end up saying sorry about certain things, but it's much more fundamentally about trying to say, look, let me try and explain to you what Christianity actually is, and let's look some of the very good questions that culture is asking and see what responses we can give. So for me, there are three elements to apologetics. Number one, there's this sense that we have to respond to good questions our culture is asking. Difficulties, objections, concerns, we need to show that good answers can be given to these good questions. Secondly, apologetics is about trying to help people to see why people might get interested in religion in the first place. What is it, for example, about Christianity that might make somebody say, this is worth thinking about, this is worth following through? And then thirdly, there's this issue of translation. That's a major theme in the writings of C.S. Lewis. It's about, in effect, taking religious language and trying to explain it using the language of our culture. So all those things taken together, that's what apologetics is.
And now your book is called Narrative Apologetics. So how is narrative apologetics different than other kinds of apologetics?
Well, many people would say that apologetics is primarily about giving arguments. Here is an argument for the existence of God. Here is an argument for the reality of sin. Narrative apologetics is about telling stories. It's saying the best way of trying to not simply explain, but also to connect with real life, what Christianity is all about, is to tell stories. And it's very significant, for example, that if we look at the gospel narratives, when Jesus is asked, for example, who is my neighbor, he does not give a dictionary definition. He tells a story, in this case, the story of the Good Samaritan. So for me, narrative apologetics is about realizing that stories capture the imagination, and in doing so, they make people receptive to or interested in what lies behind those stories. And of course, the Christian Bible is full of these stories, and these are something that we can use as we think about and explain what Christianity is all about.
Why is it, do you think, that Christian apologetics more recently has tended toward more argumentation? What is it that's made us moderns wary of narrative for the explanation and defense of Christianity?
I think modern American Christianity, until quite recently, has been deeply shaped by the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment did not like stories. How could these provisional, contingent things convey eternal truths? The important thing was to show that Christianity was rational. And certainly, that's why so many Christian apologists, particularly in North America, have focused on the development of rational arguments for faith. But, you know, we've moved on now. And in many ways, the realization of the importance of narratives has now become so significant in popular culture and indeed in the academy that we can change gear at this point. And so we might think, for example, of the massive popular appeal of stories, narratives like Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, which really engages people's imaginations, but also opens up deep questions about what life is all about, how do we relate good and evil, where do we fit into the scheme of things, and helps us see that telling the Christian story is able to begin to answer those questions.
So you return over and over to C.S. Lewis in your book here and his narrative-based apologetic. One of the things you say is that C.S. Lewis pointed out that it's impossible to convert mythos to logos without imaginative loss. Can you explain that a little bit more?
I think one of the problems we face is trying to take a story and then give a kind of one-line synopsis of that story. And in doing so, there are two things we miss. First of all, the appeal is no longer to the imagination, it's to reason. And secondly, in trying to summarize a story, mythos, in words, logos, we end up reducing it. And that means we miss stuff out. And if we talk to people who've heard a story, they'll very often find different things in that story. And therefore, by trying to summarize, by trying to reduce mythos to logos, what happens is that a rich, multifaceted story becomes a single line of argument. And what I'm trying to say in this book is that we need to respect story as story. Stories speak to different people in different ways and draws them into the story itself. And that's why I think stories continue to have a very important apologetic role.
So perhaps this connects with what we were talking about earlier about our desire to have definitive statements. Stories aren't often definitive in that way, are they? That they're open, they can be ambiguous or subject to multiple interpretations. I think at least in the American evangelical context recently, there's been such a push toward things like propositional revelation, that we want to know exactly what it is that God has said, that that's the kind of thing that stories resist to some degree, aren't they?
Very often, people present the fact that stories are so open-ended as a criticism. It's not. That's a criticism of closed-down ways of thinking. And what we need to say is that there's a serious danger that you end up in rationalist tramlines, where in effect you are in a single, concrete, linear mode of thinking, and a story says, look, it's bigger than this, it's wider than this, there's far more to this than you've realized. And that's why I think stories are such a powerful challenge, not just to the rationalism of religious people, but to the rationalism of modern American culture. It's more complex. It's richer than that. And that's one of the reasons why I think stories are so important. They don't just help us communicate what Christianity is all about. They enlarge our vision of reality precisely because they say reason on its own is not good enough.
So the word myth makes lots of Christians nervous, as we sometimes, I think, understand it to mean not really true, at least in a historical sense. But how is it that myth or story or narrative in this sense, how are stories like the Chronicles of Narnia, how are these true? How do we understand the truth of narrative?
I think many people are resistant to engaging narratives because they feel that the word myth, which is very often used in this context, means that something that is deliberately invented that is untrue. I think we need to just say, no, it's about the character, the narrative structure of a story, which captures the imagination, but also makes you receptive to the ideas that it enfolds and enframes. So the reason why, for example, the Chronicles of Narnia or indeed the Lord of the Rings are so successful is that they expand our minds. They make us receptive to bigger truths. They make us realize that the story that's being told opens up some very deep questions and also begins to frame possible answers. And to me, that's one of the reasons why stories are so important. Their imaginative appeal. That's why Lewis emphasizes that, in effect, If the story of the gospel makes us imaginatively receptive, then we can imaginatively embrace God because that makes us receptive towards the greater reality towards which these stories are pointing.
How does this apply, though, then to narratives in Scripture, like the narratives of the resurrection, which we have several accounts of in the Gospels? Is the sense of truth there different in some way, or are you happy to describe those as narratives that the truth of which are opening us up, opening our imaginations to a greater reality? Or do we need something stronger for that sense of narrative, for that kind of narrative?
I think the word truth is a very rich word. And some people say, well, truth just means something that's propositionally true. Others would say, no, it's about something that is trustworthy, something that we feel we can embrace because it opens up a way of thinking, a way of living, which actually makes sense and seems to be deeply grounded in reality. Now, let's look at the Gospels. Let's look at a theological question. Here's one. What is the love of God like? So you might say, well, of course, it is infinite. It's beyond human description. It's so wonderful, I can't really describe it. But that actually is not helpful because it tells you what the love of God is not. The Gospels do a very different thing. They, in effect, give us a story which conveys what the love of God is like. It's like someone who trudges to crucifixion willingly, who is on the cross and when invited by his critics to come down and save himself, stays there and saves us instead. In other words, this story exhibits and embodies the love of God, not as an abstract concept, but as a lived life which embodies and exhibits this love. And the result is people will look at this story, they will see it in their mind's eye, and it will speak to them far more deeply, at a different level than the propositional statement that the love of God is so wonderful it cannot be described.
Perhaps you can apply this further then to something like the problem of evil, which is one of the staples of Christian apologetics, where often those propositions seem to fall short, right? How is narrative better suited to deal with something like the problem of evil and how we might respond in that way?
I think that there are many problems like the problem of evil, which are so complex that the moment you try to reduce them to propositional statements, you realize that you have simplified to the point of distortion what the real issues are. And for me, a narrative approach to the problem of evil or the existence of suffering is really important because, in effect, it allows us to say, look, here are our personal stories. They're all about pain and suffering, the encountering of evil. Here is the story of God who becomes incarnate in Christ, who experiences suffering and evil. And we can bring these stories together, the story of us as human beings who are experiencing suffering, bewilderment, and so on, and the story of a God who willingly enters into this world, who takes on suffering and makes it a means of salvation. And it means we can realize that we can connect our story with this story. In effect, the story of our lives interconnects with and is enriched by this bigger story. And indeed, one of the points that C.S. Lewis makes, which I think is very interesting here, is that in a certain sense, faith is about allowing our story to become part of this bigger story, to be enriched and deepened as a result.
So, one of the things about argumentation is there are certain rules according to which it proceeds in logical analysis and so on. Are there criteria that we have for judging whether certain kinds of stories are better than others or more effective? Or how do we evaluate the success of different kinds of stories that might be told?
Well, I think a story is a story, and it's very hard to say this is an authentic story, this is a right story. We can certainly say that if a story is told, we want to know, did this really happen? I think that's a very important point. But very often the significance of a story does not lie simply in its historical actuality. There's always this issue of interpretation, realization of what this story means. For example, we might tell the story of Christ dying on the cross, and it might be the story of a man being put to death, and that's the end of it. But of course, for the Christians, it's far richer than that. It is a story about a man being put to death on the cross, but it's all about this remarkable transformation of the human situation so that Christ's work on the cross becomes something that affects our story. And this is why I think the whole issue of theological interpretation and above all preaching is so important, because this is not simply about repetition of the story. It is in effect saying, let's open this up and see what we find here. Let's see the possible connections with our own story. Let's see how this story may illuminate our story and begin to realize how this may help us rethink things. It doesn't always mean that the story is right. Think, for example, of David's seduction of Bathsheba. But it does say this is something from which we can learn. And in the case of the story of Christ, we're talking about, in effect, an identity-giving story for us, which becomes part of our own story as we seek to grow in our faith.
Mm-hmm. So you, one of the things I appreciate about this book is that it offers some very practical pieces of advice and strategies. You give in the middle section here three strategies for narrative apologetics, and I wonder if you might just walk us briefly through these, beginning with telling a better story. You were just referring to some of those elements of what makes a story a better story, but what is this as one of the strategies, and how might we tell better stories?
Well, this is one of the strategies that C.S. Lewis adopts, and in his sermon, The Weight of Glory, Lewis asks, how can we challenge the worldview that what you see is what you get, that there is nothing more to reality than what you observe in this material world? And he says, to break this spell, we need to cast a better spell, to tell a better story, to show that there are other ways of looking at this. And to me, that's a very important element of narrative apologetics. To be able to say, look, there's a better story that can be told about this world, about human beings, and to begin to articulate that story and invite our audience to step inside that story and ask, what does the world look like when seen from the standpoint of that story? Does that make sense? Above all, does that open up new ways of living and existence, which might want you to make that story your own story?
Mm. The second of your strategies then is seeing the Christian story as a meta-narrative. Can you explain for our audience what you mean by meta-narrative?
One of the great themes of C.S. Lewis is that Christianity tells a grand story, if you like, a meta-narrative, a story which is able to take all the threads of individual stories and connect them into a greater whole. And it's very important because it's saying that there is a coherence to our world which is otherwise overlooked, that this grand narrative, this meta-narrative, enables us to see how things hang together, how they're interconnected, and how, above all, we fit into a bigger picture. And for many people, that's the real issue. Is it just me on my own, or am I actually part of some bigger enterprise, some bigger structure, some bigger project? And for Lewis, recognizing that Christianity tells this meta-narrative means that our stories fit into this story without being drowned by this story. They're individual, they matter, but they gain dignity and depth through being part of this bigger story.
And finally, the third of these strategies you note for narrative apologetics is offering criticism of rival narratives. Is this a part two of telling a better story, or what are the kinds of criticisms that can be given to other narratives in this regard?
I think that one of the apologetic strategies that is really important is to listen to other people's criticisms of Christianity, but also to return the compliment by saying, maybe there are things you need to think about as well. And for me, challenging other stories is really important. I used to be a Marxist. I'm not anymore. And I was very much aware of Marx's story of, in effect, how human beings came to be entrapped in capitalism and what might be done to liberate this. And in effect, he told a story about how this happened and a story about how this might be changed. And initially, I found this very captivating and engaging, but I began to realize that actually it was a very vulnerable story. It was open to criticism on many fronts. And so I think there's a need to say you're telling this story, but it's not a reliable story for the following reasons. Here is an alternative narrative, which I believe is more credible and actually has an explanatory depth, which is missing from yours.
Very good. So what do we do next? What are some steps for us to incorporate a narrative apologetics into our spheres of influence, wherever we may be?
I think one of the things we can learn from narrative apologetics is simply the importance of telling stories. For example, I haven't time to do this, but supposing I were to say to you, I want to tell you the story of how I used to be an atheist and end up becoming a Christian. And actually, people would listen to that. It might be interesting, but it's all about wrestling with ideas. And as I tell my stories, I'm in effect telling how I evaluated ideas, how I came to certain conclusions. And people find stories interesting. They may not agree with them, but they want to know where they end, what the outcome is. So what I want to suggest is that maybe those listening to this podcast could say, well, look, I have a story to tell. What actually might somebody gain from listening to my story that might help them begin to answer some questions about faith, about science, and so on? What resources could you bring that you could, in effect, put into the form of the story of your life that might help somebody else who's wrestling with those same questions?
Well, thank you. What's the next chapter in your story, Alistair? What are the projects you're working on next, or the books that are on the horizon?
Well, I shall write one more book, and then that will be it. And the last
dear.
Book I'm going to write... Well, no, don't worry. The last book I'm going to write actually picks up very well the themes we've been talking about. I'm going to tell the story of how I moved from being an atheist scientist to someone who still loved scientists but had discovered theology and Christianity and began to weave a worldview around that. So in effect, it's a story of transition. It's about loving science and discovering God. It's about a journey of discovery, how an atheist became a theologian, and the kind of vision of reality that this personal journey opened up for me. Sure, it's not what everybody else will want to read about, but it explores ideas, it identifies possibilities, and I hope it might be an interesting read.
Well, we look forward very much to hearing that part of your story. Thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure to be with you, and I hope we have more conversations in the future.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the Fetzer Institute, the John Templeton Foundation, and by individual donors and listeners who contribute to BioLogos. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerworth. That's me. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. BioLogos offices are located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the Grand River watershed. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find a link in the show notes for the BioLogos Forum, or visit our website, biologos.org, where you will find articles, videos, and other resources on faith and science. Thanks for listening.